Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori on this Saturday morning, August 1st. Happy August. So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 7 to 8 on here, WLIW, online at WLIW.org and heard on podcast distributed on Audio Boom. And it's every show's archived on my website at AnneLiguori.com so you can listen to each show at your leisure. This morning, Matt Adams and Sam Querrey join me. Matt Adams is a very knowledgeable golf broadcaster who works as a golf analyst for NBC and the Golf Channel. He's a best-selling author as well. He wrote a book called The Golf Round I'll Never Forget. He also hosts a radio show called Fairways of Life, which is on the Fairways of Life app, on the website, and on 24/7, on demand, on podcast, on every major audio platform around the world. So the ubiquitous Matt Adams and I talk about golf during this pandemic, how the sport is experiencing a resurgence because it's just such a great sport to play, to social distance, families are going out. It's a great way to bond with your children. You know, camps are full of kids. Really, there's so many more people playing during this pandemic, and so we talk about that. We also talk about how Matt views this season for the professionals because of the schedule change, no Open Championship. The pandemic has really wreaked havoc on everybody's lives, and the sports world surely impacted. So we'll talk a lot about that. And then we also go in depth about Tiger Woods' game and Bryson DeChambeau, who gained about 40 pounds and is just crushing the ball off the tee. So Matt has a lot of opinions about both of those players. Then I talked to American tennis star Sam Querrey, who talks about playing world team tennis at the Greenbrier Resort in West Virginia. What a special place to host the season for the first time of world team tennis, getting everybody there for a couple weeks. And they've done a lot of testing for the virus and contained, you know, all these players in this beautiful resort area. And it's really worked out wonderfully for the tennis players. And Sam talks about it. And he actually filled in for one of the Bryan brothers the other day in one of his matches and won. Bob Bryan has a quad injury. And so Sam filled in for his buddy, Bob Bryan. And we talk about this incredible doubles team. The Bryan brothers have just legendary wins, 16 Grand Slam titles overall. They've won six Australian Open doubles titles, two French Open titles, three Wimbledon titles, and five U.S. Open doubles titles. And this may be their last. That match that they, some of their matches they played during World Team Tennis at the Greenbrier, this may be their last hurrah, so to speak, as they may retire and go down as the most successful men's doubles team in history. So we'll talk a lot about the Bryan brothers. All right, let's first look at some of the top sports stories in Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball has postponed this weekend's scheduled series between Toronto and Philadelphia because of concerns about the coronavirus after two Phillies staffers tested positive. It's the latest in a series of scheduling changes as Major League Baseball attempts to play a 60-day season. On Thursday, another player with the Miami Marlins, who recently played in Philadelphia, tested positive, bringing the total number as of Thursday night to 17 players with the Miami Marlins who have tested positive. In college football, the Southeastern Conference will only play conference games in 2020. The SEC's university presidents agreed on a 10-game schedule that eliminates all non-conference opponents, and their season will begin September 26th. The regular season was originally scheduled to begin on Labor Day weekend, but there is concern among SEC officials that the return of students to campus in the coming weeks will spike the number of COVID-19 cases. The SEC championship game originally scheduled for December 5th will now be played December 19th, which is 13 days before the college football playoff semifinals are scheduled to be played on New Year's Day. And finally in golf, Brooks Koepka, who's the defending champion of the FedEx St. Jude Invitational in Memphis, Tennessee, matched his career best round on Thursday in round one. Koepka shot an 8-under-62 to take a one-shot lead over Ricky Fowler. Last week at the 3M PGA Tour stop, Brooks Koepka missed the cut. He's been struggling with a knee injury and says it's not 100% yet. But on Thursday, he made 9 birdies and 1 bogey on his way to 8-under-62. He credits his work with coach Claude Harmon and Pete Cowan. Koepka is a two-time defending champion of the PGA Championship, which takes place next week at TPC Harding Park in San Francisco. Sports Interview with Allegory is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. Dune Jewelry, DUNEJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses, zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. PeakVision.com. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. My guest, Matt Adams, host analyst for NBC, The Golf Channel, New York Times bestselling author, The Golf Round I'll Never Forget. Love that book, by the way. And host of Fairways of Life Radio, which airs Monday through Fridays, 8 a.m. on Fairways of Life apps, website, and 24/7 on demand on podcast in every major audio platform around the world. The ubiquitous Matt Adams. Welcome to Sports Interview.
Hello, Ann. How have you been?
I've been good, thank you, in this crazy, uncertain time that we're all going through right now.
Sure.
And let's start with that, because it really has been such a strange time, to say the least, with this pandemic. Yet golf has really led the way in the sports world, Matt, with their safety measures, their testing protocols, social distancing aspects of the sport itself. Obviously, golf is great at that. But how do you think this 2020 golf season will be viewed in history when we look back on it?
I definitely think it's going to be an asterisk. I think that there's the only thing that we can compare it to is the period during the Second World War, when there was a suspension of major championships and play at large. The tour was suspended for years during that time, until such time as, you know, Byron Nelson had his run and at the end of it, and then everyone started coming back and making the tour as we know it today. That was post-World War II, was when we start to get into the tour as we know it. You're talking about Snead, Hogan, leading into Palmer, which leads into Nicklaus, which takes us in earnest right up to the present day. So I think that's the only way that we can look at it, is to say that this is an aberration. I mean, what of the Open? There's not even going to be a 2020 Open on the record books. At least with the other three majors, there will be. You'll have to dig into it a little bit 100 years from now to realize that they weren't held in their regular time spot. But aside from that, you know, aside from the professional tours, what's interesting, Ann, is that on the amateur level, the 99.99% that I like to say, that where I worked for years on that side of the game, golf is absolutely booming right now. And yeah, it is for many of the reasons that you've already outlined, that they realized pretty quickly that if you look at the charts of the most dangerous activities that you can engage in, going to a bar, going, say, to a concert hall or a club, going to a large gathering where people are close together, even if they're singing or speaking loudly, it's very dangerous, especially if those people obviously are not wearing masks or not covered. So as a result of that, they looked at golf and said, wait a minute, you're talking about people being outside. They are, by the very nature of the game, generally social distanced. If you're conscious of it, you can be even more so on the mark of the same. And they realized that golf is a great sport for a variety of different reasons. Well, golf right now, as you and I are speaking, is absolutely booming. Where you are in the Northeast, it is up over 15-17%. Where I am in the Southeast, it's bumping on 20% up year over year. That even if you take into account the weeks and in some cases months that golf was not allowed to be played at the height of the lockdown, it's still up for the year. So it's absolutely remarkable. And in a very bizarre way, I think golf, almost on every level, can actually come out of this being the beneficiary of people realizing that maybe what they thought golf was previously is not tremendously on mark because they gave it a try and they found it to be a healthy endeavor and something that's a lot of fun.
That's right. The ironies are unbelievable. I was just playing Gardner's Bay over the weekend, and Lee Notley, the director of golf, the pro over there, said his rounds are up 50%. This time, this from last year. So it's just, and everywhere you go, you hear that and you see that, and families are playing. Kids don't have camps to go to. So, you know, mom and dad are taking out the kids. They're learning the game. They're taking golf lessons. The junior programs are thriving. It's great to see, really.
It's fantastic to see. It's what the game needs. It's, you know, on the equipment side of what I do, the big concern was, because you know as well as anybody, that equipment goes in cycles. And we went through a period where those cycles were getting shorter and shorter and shorter, and it was to drive new product through the marketplace, down the pipeline, so that they could show what they wanted to from a quarterly performance and to enhance stocks. Now that those product cycles have started to spread out again, because the retail distribution chains were saying, wait a minute, you're loading us up with this product, which we then summarily have to discount 6 months later. And consumers got smart and they said, well, I'm not going to buy the new driver now. I'm just going to wait 3 to 6 months and it's going to be discounted by 20-30%. And then I'll pick it up then. So this, with all of it happened in 2020, the big question was, will we see new product introduced at all? In other words, to back up a product that was the latest, greatest that we were introduced to at the PGA Merchandise Show, or will they wait until a whole nother season? Will they actually skip a whole cycle? Because of everything kicking off again, because of things are moving, because product is moving, I think we're going to see the new introductions of product on a fairly regular cycle to what we would have seen regardless of what's happening with the pandemic. So even that is a very interesting development. And if you're a person that loves the new introduction of product and loves to see the new technology, whether you engage in it at that time or just like to see it, like I love to see what they're doing with new stuff, I think you're going to see it on a fairly regular schedule, which was very much in doubt only a few weeks ago.
Sure. You wonder if people are really spending the money on the next best putter or driver, you know, and during this time. I think, you know, they're playing golf, but are they really spending the extra dollars to buy new equipment?
Yeah, what we're seeing right now is that equipment sales are going quite well. What's interesting is that how it's going quite well. I'll take one company, for example, Ben Hogan Golf. Great name, right? Lineage back to 1953, founded by the namesake Ben Hogan himself. It went through its ups and downs. In 2017, the current ownership group put together the structure of what Ben Hogan Golf is right now. What it is right now, and it is direct to the consumer, so that they're coming out with all the latest and greatest in terms of technology. They're one of the sponsors of the Fairways Life Show. Latest and greatest in terms of technology, latest and greatest in terms of the artistry that they're doing, micromanufacturing one at a time, obviously, but based on order. But the consumer's saving 40-50% because there's no retailer in the middle. They cannot keep product in stock. Now, whether you liken that to just a business growth on their part, which you certainly hope that is the case, I can't, in my mind, separate it from what's going on with the pandemic, where people are going, I'm able to play golf again, whether it's 50% up where you played, or the average of the Northeast up 15-17%, or the rest of the country up massive percentages as well. Whatever the reason is, people want to go out and play with the latest and greatest. And I do believe that's got to do with the pandemic, both in physical activity that they're engaged in and a mental perspective that you're taking to it, where they go, you know what? We just learned that you only go around once, and crazy things can happen to upend your life that you think is so set in stone that nothing's going to change. Things can change. So I'm not waiting. I'm going to go out and get that set of club or driver, whatever it is, right now. I think that's part of the mentality.
Let's go back to what you said about the pro game, and that this season you think will have an asterisk by it. Obviously, they canceled the Open Championship for this season. We have the PGA Championship coming up. We have the U.S. Open. They just announced there will be no spectators at the U.S. Open at Wingfoot. No spectators, obviously, at the PGA Championship. You know, the schedule has been totally rearranged. No spectators. COVID-19 testing. Very controlled environment. It just, what a year. Yet, going back to golf leading the way, You know, I really think, you know, the golf industry has set a very positive example when you look at all these other sports that are trying to get out there to do the same.
And I hope they do the same, and I hope it's successful for them as well, with, you know, basketball getting back underway again the last few days, and baseball is underway again. Not many games in, but they're underway. Hockey's getting ready in earnest as well. So it's exciting to see. It makes me think that, and I guess from a writer's perspective here, is that sport has always been in some way a metaphor for, or at least a reflection of, life itself. The triumph, the tragedy, everything that goes with it, the joyfulness, the euphoria, the coming together as a constituency to cheer on a team, sometimes as a family, sometimes the marked contrast within those same confines in terms of where allegiances lie. So sport for us is important. When you look at what Michael Murphy wrote in his 1971 golf fiction, which was brilliant, the best-selling golf fiction of all time, called Golf in the Kingdom, he called sport Western meditation. It means so much to our mindset, to our psyche, to our sense of where balance is in our world, maybe in our universe. So the fact that golf came back first, the fact that golf used all those things that we were talking about earlier, the reality of the game and how it naturally lends itself towards social distancing, if you please, and towards a healthy engagement, and that with no roadmap, with no textbook whatsoever, they were able to put together a means of bringing back an entire league so that we at home could enjoy the sport as we used to. Granted, there are no fans there, and that has an impact. It's more fun when the holes are lined with people. But at the end of the day, we're still seeing great competition. I mean, if you look at what happened last week when Michael Thompson won, the amount of emotion that he had when he was so steady down the stretch, but the emotion that he had after that victory, his first since 2013, that was real and very enjoyable and very engaging. And we've got this coming week coming up, we've got a major, the first one of the calendar year in the PGA Championship. So for so many reasons, I think it's been noble, and I think it's been a great effort by the game of golf. I'm not saying it was perfect. They're learning as they go, and they've admitted that to us. But the fact that what they're doing for their business structure and for our enjoyment as fans, I think it's absolutely fantastic.
I agree with you. Let's talk about several players, Matt, starting with Tiger Woods. To date, we've only seen him at the Memorial, where he finished tied for 40th, his only tournament so far since February. He skipped Memphis. And, you know, he says he's doing what he thinks is best to prepare for the PGA Championship. And again, in an ironic way, you know, this pandemic has, I really feel, affected Tiger so much. Do you think it's good or bad? I mean, he hasn't been really practicing outside of his backyard, and, you know, the medalist, wherever he is down in Florida. But how do you, what are your thoughts about Tiger? It just seems like, you know, we're not seeing much of him. He's totally cut back on his schedule, obviously, for physical reasons. But what are your thoughts about Tiger at this point?
My thoughts with Tiger in general is that he is the classic enigma wrapped in a mystery and drizzled with riddles. And much of that is by his own style and personality. Tiger has never liked revealing details of who he is. Now, whether that led to, you know, his kind of social downfall in 2009, because he was so secretive in terms of, and so controlling in terms of how he and his team controlled his image and the information that he dispensed, that once it all hit the fan, everybody ran with it, you know, like madmen. You know, maybe that was part of it. I don't know. But even if you look at it, well, the last time we saw Tiger and he was doing his flashy interview, was actually Rex Hoggard from Golf Channel was asking the questions. And he said, well, you know, what are you going to do about getting more reps? And Tiger said, reps or competitive reps? And Rex came back and said, competitive reps. And Tiger came back and said, well, I definitely need more reps. And so that was it. That was the information that we got in terms of when are you going to play, where are you going to play, and what. Before the pandemic, when Tiger couldn't play at Bay Hill, when Tiger couldn't play at the Players, we all, and I think rightfully so, were worried, because it seemed like a sign that the surgically repaired back, or any one of the other areas that he's had multiple surgeries on his body, something was wrong. Something had flared up again. he has come back continually and said, look, it's a day-by-day issue. Some days it's good. Some days it isn't good. You know, look at what he did at the Zozo. It looked like he couldn't be, he beat. Look at what he did at the President's Cup. He quite physically could not be beat. He was playing so well. And so we all had hope. But then we saw what happened in the spring. He had weeks, months of healing to go through in the pandemic. And we thought, okay, well, he's going to come back again. Everyone had high hopes. He came back and he had one day when he shot a 76 Memorial and when he said the back was flaring up. But even outside of that, he didn't play well. It was mediocre at best. And one could say there was a lot of rust, at least in terms of what we saw from Tiger Woods. So how taking this past week, this week off from competing, will put him in a position to be better able to compete at the PGA Championship in Harding Park, where traditionally it's going to be cool in Northern California and along the Pacific Ocean. I don't know. I guess I don't have high hopes for the prospects of Tiger Woods. I hate to say for my sake and that of every other fan of the game of golf at the PGA Championship, because the last time we saw him, we saw two things. We saw a tremendous amount of competitive rust. Two, we saw the back flare up specifically that kept him, as he was saying, from completing his swing. So for those two reasons, I think notwithstanding the euphoria that surrounds Tiger, I don't know what he's going to say in the next few days if and when he addresses the media and Tiger comes in and says, I feel great, been practicing at home, the back is not a problem, I know how to win majors, I've won 15 of them, I'm ready to go. And we all get swept up in the euphoria and we all say, maybe this is going to be number 16, he marches that much closer to Jack Nicklaus. But with everything that we've seen so far in the real lens of reality, I just don't see it happening.
Oh, I don't either. I mean, he's just rusty. He just hasn't been able to play. He's become probably more honest and open lately than we've ever heard Tiger Woods, because he, you know, is constantly referring to the fact that he is getting old. He's not young anymore. His body is breaking down and continues to break down. So I think we're obviously, it seems like we're seeing Tiger on his last leg, so to speak. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But I know, you know, putting wise, he did say that he's been playing, you know, in Florida, playing on Bermuda greens and not seeing breaks. And, you know, that's greatly affected his putting. But I mean, it's so much more than that. It's basically his body breaking down and he's admitting to his age.
Yeah, I think you're 100% correct on all of that. What's interesting where you said that Tiger is more revealing than he's been in the past, it tends to go in a pattern, though. The pre-tournament Tiger is pretty much a traditional Tiger. The message he's going to give you is that he's never felt better, he's never felt stronger, he's never been more prepared. I'm paraphrasing, but that's generally
sure.
It. It's the post-tournament Tiger that is, that especially if things don't go well, where Tiger kind of throws his palms up to the air and says, well, what are you guys expecting? I had major back surgery.
Right.
Now, you know, because of the way that the game is played, whenever you're communicating from a journalist perspective with Tiger or Phil, there are rules to that game. And the basic rules, whether the public knows this or not, is you play the game that they want to play, because if you push too hard, if you delve too deep, if you're in any way accusatory or rude with the manner in which you address these legends, you essentially will get shut down. The next time that, because there's only so many questions that can be asked in that setting, and your hand up is not going to be one that's picked the next time. That's just, it's the unspoken rule, and I know I'm revealing inside baseball to you. So that's the reason why, even in the exchange with Tiger, in my opinion, which was, when Tiger said, you mean competitive reps or reps? And Rex said, competitive reps. And Tiger said, I definitely need reps. Okay. That's the reason why you didn't hear a follow-up by multiple journalists at that point going, Tiger, could you define what you just said? What did you mean? Reps. Does that mean at home? Or you're actually going to go out and compete on tour and get yourself ready with a, you know, scorecard and pencil in hand versus zipping around a golf course in a golf cart. So it's a very interesting dynamic with Tiger Woods. And I'm a massive fan of Tiger being a part of the game because of what he does in terms of firing up enthusiasm and the ratings that he brings to it and all the rest from the media side of the game. There's a definite benefit when he's there, but there's also a great deal of complexity as to who he is.
Oh, absolutely. And you're so right about what you can and cannot ask Tiger Woods and who they pick to ask these questions. It is very skewed. And that's a whole other subject that we can talk about one day. But not just with Tiger Woods. It's just who you are and who they choose to ignore as far as asking questions and picking those to ask questions. And but that's, you know, that's a whole other thing. Bryson DeChambeau. In a matter of a few months, Matt Adams, he purposely gained over 40 pounds. I don't know anybody who purposely gains that much weight. And he's just bombing the ball off the tee, leading the tour in driving distance. Now, in my opinion, he's bordering on being too heavy. And I, for the life of me, don't know how somebody too heavy can get that club head speed up to where he needs to have it to bomb the ball off the tee like he is doing it. So is there a chance he could get, because he admits he's eating just unlimited amounts of food. It's just, to me, it's almost like a health issue, too. To gain that much weight in a short period of time is not healthy. But look at his driving distance. So it's kind of like a two-edged sword there for me.
You know what it sounds like in this conversation, Ann LaGorie? It sounds like you and I are sitting around in the grill room as a couple of parents and having this conversation. Because I think what happens with Bryson is that we all forget that he's 26 years old. My two boys who are home because there's no school right now, obviously, with the lockdown and the pandemic, at 20 and 22, are drinking their protein shakes and lifting their weights and going running and flexing in the mirror and doing all the stuff that these young guys do. Bryson is a professional athlete, even though he's got the image of being, you know, the almost a rocket scientist if
That's
you get
right
down to it. And he's got all that image. I get it. I realize that he's a very smart guy, but he's still a 26-year-old man. And I think part of what's going on here is that he's got a lot of attributes in his character that remind me of Phil Mickelson. He loves the spotlight.
Right.
He loves to be the center of attention. He loves to tell you what his theories are. And the beauty of Bryson DeChambeau is that when we hear it, we may scratch our head. We may roll our eyes. We may look at each other and go, you know what, Ann, I don't know if I'm buying that. It doesn't matter if we buy it. He's buying it. So it's working for him. With Bryson DeChambeau, if you look at, you know, everyone's giving all the credit to this massive weight game and strength training in terms of what he's doing and how far he's hitting it. If you take that out of the scenario, just hear me out here on this, take the weight gain and the strength out of the scenario for 1 second and look at how much harder he's swinging at the golf ball than the way that he swang at it in the past. That alone is going to equate to more distance. He's swinging so hard that his entire left leg, knee, and left foot go from being closed to completely spitting out on his heel and being open, because if he didn't do that, he would blow his knee out. So risk there,
sure.
I suppose, if that ever doesn't move, there's definitely going to be a risk there. So the formula with Bryson, as it is with a lot of things, is more complex than just what meets the eye, which is that physical change in his shape and what he's doing in the gymnasium, what he's doing with this massive consumption of calories on a daily basis. He is swinging incredibly hard. To swing that hard is a credit to his, what he calls his one plane swing. Because when you swing that hard, particularly when you have to have that much torsional stress going left, it tends to shut the club face down for two reasons. One, the shaft starts to bow forward. You know how when you pull a bow and arrow back and the bow is bowing towards you?
Mm-hmm.
A shaft will tend to start to bow the opposite direction when you're swinging that hard. When it bows that opposite direction, you also get torsional force on the club head, which means the club head and face starts to close like a doorway. As a result, your ball tends to start left and go left, which means the face angle is left, which is going to push the ball on a leftward direction, but the face is also torquing closed at the same time, which is going to put a spin on the ball that is from right to left, which is going to add to it. So the thing to watch with Bryson is that when the stress really starts to surround him, which will be fascinating next week at the PGA Championship in particular, is does Bryson start to lose the ball left? If he's starting to lose the ball left, then what he's losing there is his timing coming into the golf ball and not staying square with the club face and body rotation at impact so that he can hit it these tremendous distances, because he tends to be playing a right-to-left shape on the golf ball anyway. If he can control that, both with what I was saying, with how hard he's swinging at the golf ball, and that's a credit to his golf swing. Add to it the 26-year-oldness, which is, in my opinion, which is the changing the physical form and wanting to be the biggest guy in the room, which I think in many ways, a kid who we see bravado in, a kid that we see great confidence in, also have the insecurities that go with young men that oftentimes manifest themselves in the former. I think it's going to be a fascinating thing to see it play out.
Oh, I think he's just a fascinating study. He is so compelling to watch and to hear, you know, him talk about, you know, the scientific aspects of his swing and the game overall. But are you suggesting he's swinging so hard that that aspect of his improvement with his distance is really not related to his weight gain?
Yes. I'm suggesting that it's both. But but a part of it that's not getting the credit and the exposure that it deserves is his golf swing is so his own, and it is so on point right now that he is swinging so incredibly hard that he's able to maintain the flight of that golf ball on his desired target. When that starts to lose itself is when pressure starts to mount. Most of the players start to lose their feel in the small muscle movement. And that's when you see someone getting a little bit off. Even you can see it manifest like, not this week, but last with Richie Wierenski, where in that final round, his body started getting very fast, which is we see very typically in the best in the world when the nerves start to kick in. You see it in little ways, which Bryson has had, sometimes putts beautifully and sometimes doesn't. Lee Trevino used to say that when the stress starts to come on, right-handed putters tend to miss short and right. That's another thing. These are all the little things that, you know, on the inside when we're broadcasting events live, when I'm on course doing live play-by-play, these are the things that I'm watching for. The pace and the tempo of the swing, the physical manifestation of what they're doing with the golf club in hand in that heat of the moment, and how does it change from when they're at the absolute pinnacle of who they are. So, yeah, I think that Bryson's gains in distance are not only about gains in the gymnasium and gains in terms of pounds. It's also in terms of gains in terms of how hard he is swinging. Does one aid the other? Obviously, yes, it does. But he would have greater distance even if he didn't put on more weight because of the way that he's ripping at the golf ball.
That's a great observation. Everybody's talking about the weight gain, but I think that the hardness of the swing, as you mentioned, is really more responsible for this distance. Well, Matt, thank you so much. We could go on and on. I have so many more questions, so we'll have to do a part two.
I loved it. I'm honored to do it. I love what you have done. You know that. I've been a fan for years and years and years, and long may it continue, and I appreciate the time.
Thanks so much. Matt Adams, host, analyst, NBC Golf Channel.
Sports Interview with Anne Liguori is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. Dune Jewelry, D-U-N-E Jewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses, zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game, peakvision.com.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. And now to one of my favorite sports, tennis. And Sam Querrey, who is the fourth highest-ranked American-ranked male in tennis. I've watched Sam play at the U.S. Open on the Ash Court for many, many years, and I'm delighted, Sam, to have you on the show. Welcome to Sports Interview.
Thank you for having me.
So you've won 10 singles titles, 5 doubles titles, and you're playing world team tennis in none other than at the Greenbrier Resort in West Virginia. What a venue for this season's World Team Tennis, right?
It's incredible. I mean, usually World Team Tennis, where it's a 3-week season, we're traveling around from city to city, and you've got one day in a city. And so this year, because of the pandemic, we're here for 3 weeks, and I've never been here before. I don't think any of the players had been here before, but it's an incredible resort. And I mean, the tennis is great, but outside of the tennis, it's even better. There's golf, and there's ATV riding, and there's archery and skeet shooting. So it's been a fun 3 weeks.
I can say, 3 weeks at the Greenbrier. There's worse places to be for sure. Tell me about some of your golf, because I'm actually going to be there shortly to experience the Greenbrier for the very first time, And in addition to seeing world team tennis, watching the finals, which we'll talk about in a second, what about the golf? I can't wait to play the golf courses there.
The golf courses are incredible. There's four courses. One is a private course, so that one's a little tougher to get on. But the other three are open for us to play. And as players, it's been free golf for all World Team Tennis players for the last 3 weeks. So a lot of the men and the women have been out there playing. A handful of people brought their clubs. I didn't, just because living on the West Coast is a little bit of a trek to bring them out here. But it's been great. And not only playing the golf, the place where we have lunch every day looks over the golf course, so you get to watch golf. And actually yesterday and today and maybe tomorrow, they have the West Virginia Amateur Championships going on. So there's kind of like a little tournament going on right now. So it's a great golf venue here as well.
And talk about the Greenbrier as a tennis venue. What's the stadium like, and what's the atmosphere been like?
It's great. I mean, they've got a proper stadium that could hold, I'm kind of guessing, about 2,500 people if they need. Obviously, we don't have that many here. It's where everyone's social distance, and there's maximum 500 people. It's maybe been more like 200-300 every day. But they've got a great center court. They've built a temporary indoor court for World Team Tennis because it has thunderstormed a handful of days we're here. So they're ready to go inside, which they've done 6 or 7 times. And then they've got, I think, 5 or 6 beautiful clay courts here that are getting used by the guests every day. And if you just go into the tennis club here at the Greenbrier on the wall, they've got pictures of Sampras, Agassi, McEnroe, and so many other great players. And they've done like amazing tennis events here for the last 25 years, it seems like.
So there's a real history, not only of golf there, but obviously with tennis. And you played on the Vegas Rollers, part of World Team Tennis, and just finished this past Wednesday with a victory over Venus Williams and the Washington Castles, which eliminated Washington from the playoff picture. So what's it been like to play, team tennis there?
It's been fun. I was on the Rollers last year. I grew up in Vegas, so it's fun to kind of be on a team that is a little bit close to my roots. And we've, although our team didn't make the playoffs, we had a really fun team. We had the Bryan brothers and Monica Puig and Asia Muhammad, Isla Tomjanovic, and Christy Ahn on our team. And our coach is Tim Blankiron, who's a Vegas guy. And it's been fun. Usually tennis is an individual sport most of the year. And so this is kind of one of those few times you get to be on a team, you get to hang out with people you normally wouldn't hang out with. And it's been a blast. And, I think all the players here were just happy to have some type of kind of real tournament to go back to, because no one's done anything for 4 or 5 months.
All right. And you normally, so the people who might not follow World Team Tennis, each team normally travels to play various teams in the league, right, in the organization. And this is the first time you've all just kind of been at one resort. I think you probably liked it so much. I would assume you'd all want to do the same thing next year, right?
We do, yeah. It has been great. I mean, it is a bummer. It is fun when you're home and you've got the home crowd, because it does liven things up a little bit. But like you said, it's a lot of travel. It's only a 3-week season, but, it's a lot of – you'll be on the road. You'll play in Orlando on Monday, in Philadelphia on Tuesday, in New York on Wednesday, in Springfield on Thursday, fly home, and then play in San Diego the next day. So it's a ton of travel, although it's over a short window, but this is ideal. We're here, we're at a resort, the off days you can practice, and anytime you could be in one place, I think all athletes kind of like that.
So you made an unexpected men's doubles debut with none other than Mike Bryan, subbing in for his twin brother, Bob Bryan, who's actually dealing with a quad injury. And how did that go?
It went well. We played great last night, and we won our double match 5-2. A little bit of pressure replacing one of the Bryan brothers, but fortunately it worked out. And I've known them since I was 10 years old. So we've been friends for a long time, so we've played Davis Cup together, so I'm very comfortable with Mike and Bob. So it wasn't too much of a transition for me.
And they're talking about doubles. I mean, you've done very well in doubles. You've won 5 doubles titles in your career, so you're no stranger to doubles. But when you're talking about the Bryan brothers, that is the most legendary doubles team in really, I think, the history of tennis, right?
Oh yeah, agreed. the numbers are so high, I might be misquoting these. I think they've won 119 tournaments together. And then, you know, Bob Bryant had a hip surgery last year. Mike teamed up with Jack Sock. They won a Wimbledon and a U.S. Open. They've won Olympic gold. They've won Davis Cups. They've won all four Grand Slams. There's really nothing that they haven't accomplished on the doubles court. And then also, you know, they've won like the fan favorite award for doubles for 12 straight years. And they do a ton of clinics and charity exhibitions. So they're just incredible ambassadors for the sport. And, you know, they're always out there promoting tennis with a smile on their face. And their dad's very involved, Wayne Bryan, and in putting together clinics and exhibitions. So they've just been incredible for tennis for 20 plus years.
And I know they've been, considering retirement for a bit now. And is it possible that this World Team Tennis season may have been the last hurrah for this formidable doubles team in pro tennis?
No one knows. I hope they come back and play a little more because, you know, they're my friends. They still play at a high level. But, you know, Mike just had a baby. Bob has three kids. So they're going to have to sit down and chat and see kind of what it looks like next year for them. And I personally hope they come back, but whatever decision they make is fine. They've put in a lot of time. If this was it, they deserve to kind of go out and do something else for a little bit.
They're just incredible. What a team, as you say. They're such great ambassadors for the sport globally. Let's talk about you, Sam. I mean, first of all, with this World Team Tennis environment, I mean, what's it like as you're hanging out with the Bryan brothers, whom you've known for years, but Kim Clijsters came back and you have Venus Williams and Sloane Stephens and a lot of interesting personalities. And it how different is this team tennis, not only with the format, obviously, but just with kind of the camaraderie and it's probably a little, less intense, maybe, I don't know, than the tour?
You know, it's got a little bit of both. So this year is different. There's been, this year, the winning team splits $500,000. So this is the first time they've ever done that. So
wow.
I will say it's a little more intense this year. People are more into it. The effort level is maybe a little more intense. And, you know, the best part, which I alluded to earlier, is you kind of become friends with people you would never normally hang out with. And that's the best part. And you kind of, after World Team Tennis is done, you'll follow along with these people's kind of career, and at tournaments, you'll go have lunch together. And usually World Team Tennis doesn't have a field this strong. I think part of it was because of the pandemic. No one's played. A lot of top players wanted to play, but, a lot of times you have to miss normal ATP or WTA events in order to play World Team Tennis. And this year with nothing else going on, I think that's part of the reason why you got Kim Clijsters, Sloane Stephens, Sophia Kennan, and so many other like top players playing this, which has made the league incredibly strong and incredibly, fun this season.
Right. And as far as, dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, what has the environment been like for the players? And I mean, are you tested often? How different has it been with this pandemic going on?
It's been everything in life is kind of more difficult and not as fun, but they did a great job of putting protocols in place early. Everyone had to, not only players, but anyone who was with the player, whether it was the coach, a spouse, a trainer, whoever, you had to present a negative test within 5 days of coming here. And then the first day that you arrived, before you checked in, you were taken to a test center and you were then given another rapid test, which everyone luckily tested negative for. And then after week one, everyone again took another rapid test. You wear masks, indoors pretty much everywhere. The resort, which sounds like you're familiar with, it is very spread out and outdoorsy, so you can walk around outside and be in your room without a mask. But everywhere else, you got the mask on. There's, kind of no going to the casino. There's no high-fiving on the court. Little things like that. And everyone's abiding by the rules. And so far there's been no issues. And so as long as we do that, it seems to be working well, and hopefully other tournaments can look at this kind of format and the way things are run here, and tennis can start moving along and pumping more events out, which it looks like we are. I saw that Cincinnati and US Open look very promising. And so hopefully we can, keep keep running these events.
Sure. And I want to talk about that in a second, the U.S. Open. But before I move to the U.S. Open, what about the spectators, the crowds there? How have the crowds been at the Greenbrier?
They've been good. There's a few hundred people each day, and they've got the stadium blocked. Every other row is blocked off. People have common sense. If you're in the same group, you're sitting next to each other. If you're kind of in a different group of people, the stadium is big enough where everyone's spread out. If you're watching, you got a mask on. If we go indoor, you got a mask on. So people are being nice and following the rules. And as long as they do that, everything's good.
And I do want to remind everybody that the World Team Tennis Playoffs begin today from the Greenbrier with New York versus Philadelphia at 2 p.m. and Orlando against Chicago at 5 p.m. on CBS Sports Network. And then the finals will air live on CBS at noon on Sunday. So any predictions there, Sam?
Philadelphia and Chicago do seem like they've been the most dominant teams. So I'm gonna guess if I had a bet, which I would never do, I would say Philadelphia would take the title. But I think I feel like I'm cheering for Orlando.
Oh, you are. How?
Yeah,
how
I don't
is
know
that?
Why, but I don't really have a reason. They're just out of the four teams left. I hope Orlando gets the title.
Oh, good for you. And who's on the Philadelphia team that makes it so strong in your opinion?
They have Taylor Fritz in men's singles.
Oh, okay.
They've got Sophia Kennan for the women's singles. And then they have Taylor Townsend, who's a fantastic player and always seems to step up her game in World Team Tennis and is great in the women's doubles and the mixed doubles. And they have Fabrice Martin playing doubles for them as well. So they're strong at like every spot.
So talk about the U.S. Open, which is coming up, starts the last Monday in August and goes for 14 straight days. I've been covering the U.S. Open forever. And I know this is the first time I will not be on the premises to actually cover the tennis. There'll be no spectators and there'll be only the rights holders in television covering it on the premises. So this is going to be, from a media standpoint, it's going to be so... Normally I'm in my broadcast booth overlooking the Ash Stadium court on the upper level. And this year I'm going to have to be in my office watching every second on TV and having access obviously to the press conferences and the releases, et cetera. But you know, from a playing standpoint, how do you think it's going to be with no spectators at the U.S. Open?
You know, I don't know. And no one does. And not only the spectators, it just, you know, the staff that's around and the restaurants on the grounds that are open and the bars, it's going to feel shut down. It's almost going to feel like, you know, when we get to the Open a week early and it's kind of a ghost town out there, I feel like it'll feel like that, but even less. So I don't know what to expect. I don't think any of the players know what to expect. I think at the end of the day, everyone's just kind of happy that we're going to play it. We've got a tournament and it doesn't matter what the circumstances are. And at the, the current situation we've got in the world, we'll take what we can get. And it's hard to be picky at this current time.
I guess when you look back on 2020, if we can project a little bit, do you think this season, well, with so many tournaments, ATP tournaments and WTA tournaments basically canceled and, you know, so many of these majors moved and the U.S. Open with no spectators, will there be an asterisk on this season, in your opinion?
For sure. You know, and we still don't know what there's a chance that the U.S. Open could get canceled. You know, there's this, everything seems to change every week, and I hope it doesn't. I hope it goes forward, which I think it will. And, you know, the French Open's moved, and it looks like Rome and Madrid are going to be okay. But there's still going to be a little bit of an asterisk, like you said. But at the end of the day, I think with all sports, we're just trying to get through it, just trying to do the best we can. Hopefully, a vaccine can get in the works as quick as possible, which seems to be happening, and we can get back to normal life.
Well, let's think of happier times when you hit 10 consecutive aces against James Blake in a match in Indianapolis. Oh my gosh. I'm sure that's top of mind a lot with your tennis most memorable moments, right?
Definitely, yeah, that was a fun one, and you know, it makes it even better because James and I are friends, so it's always fun when you get to do something like that against a buddy. So I could rub it in his face forever.
Oh, I'm sure he loves that. And your best performance in a major was getting to the semis at Wimbledon in 2017. And your best performance going back to the U.S. Open was getting to the quarterfinals in 2017. So talk a little bit about first the U.S. Open and in 2017, what was that run like for you getting to the quarters?
It was awesome. I mean, I had played the U.S. Open. That was probably my 12th or 13th year playing it. So I was no stranger to playing in New York. But, you know, that was my best year on tour. And I had semi in Wimbledon, like you said, and I had won two other tournaments, one in Acapulco, one in Cabo San Lucas. So I was confident and feeling good. And I think that was actually the first year I ever got to play a night match at the U.S. Open. I got to play a couple of them, which was really fun. And, you know, that's something that as a young, you know, tennis player growing up, you always watch the U.S. Open night matches. And to finally get to play one was really special. And to win it made it even a little better.
Right, and so you know what it's like to be, you know, prime time at the U.S. Open on the Ash Court with so many fans cheering you on, and to go back there potentially this year and to be on the Ash Court potentially with no fans. Gosh, that's going to be crazy, crazy different. But how about Wimbledon getting to the semis? What are your memories of the semifinals at Wimbledon in 2017?
I mean, that was special too. I had made the quarterfinals the year before there. I'd always actually done pretty well at Wimbledon. I liked playing on grass. I was comfortable there. But again, to make the semis was incredible. And it's one thing, I always kind of say this, it's really, if you ever get to play Wimbledon, it's great. And I've been fortunate to play it 13 times. And then if you get to play on center court, it's even cooler. And then to win a match on center court, it's even cooler. So that was kind of you know, I didn't win the tournament, but it's still a dream come true. And it's always fun to make a run at that tournament because that one really feels like it's kind of almost the most well-known event around the world as far as tennis goes.
Well, with your big serve and forehand, is the grass surface obviously more conducive to the strengths in your game? Or is it the same with maybe hard courts?
No, I think it definitely helps a little more on the grass. Some hard courts can be faster, some can be slower. The grass is always a little fast, so it helps with my serve. It helps with my forehand. I like to try to hit and come forward, and that's conducive on the grass as well. And a lot of times you play well at the same tournaments over and over. There's something comforting about Wimbledon, so I've always just been confident there. And so everything is kind of just usually clicks there for me.
I'm sure you're bummed when they canceled Wimbledon outright for this year, right, with the pandemic.
Totally bummed. Oh my gosh. Yeah. You know, especially I'm 32. I turned 33 later this year. You never know how many more years you have to play, and to lose one of them here is a huge bummer.
You started playing at the age of 4.
Yeah. I mean, I think most pro players started playing tennis, you know, at 4 or 5. And, you know, I played tennis, football, baseball, basketball, soccer. I played all those sports at 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, up until my freshman year of high school. So I was just the best at tennis and kind of stuck with it.
And you turned pro in 2006, but you were considering playing college tennis at the University of Southern California?
Yep. I had signed. I was going to go play college at University of Southern California. And the summer before school started, I had a lot of success playing some smaller level pro tournaments and won a couple of them, and then got a wild card into the U.S. Open actually and won my first round there. And so by the time school would have started, I was already maybe ranked 115 or 120 in the world. So it actually wasn't too difficult of a decision to kind of skip college and just go straight to the pro tour.
Was golf ever a consideration, or you just play it for fun?
No, I just play it for fun. And a lot of the tennis players do. I mean, John Isner, Steve Johnson, and some of the guys a little older than us, Andy Roddick, James Blake, Marty Fish, they all play golf. I think it's something with the hand-eye coordination must be kind of easy for us to pick up because we're all golfing quite often.
Yeah, and you're not bad. You said you're a 10 handicap in golf. And, well, you know, Marty Fish just won. He was the first tennis player to win the American Century Championship. I had Marty on the show a couple weeks ago.
No, he's the best of all the tennis players. But even guys like Steve Johnson and Jack Sock, they play a lot of golf. They're closer to kind of 3 and 4 handicap players. So I think James Blake and Andy Roddick are single-digit handicap players. So there's a lot of good tennis players on the American side that are good golfers.
Why do you think, Sam, tennis players can take up golf? I don't want to say easily, because golf is like the most challenging sport. I play a lot of golf, and a lot of, you know, pros in other sports will say that they're so humbled by hitting a stationary ball, right? Why do you think so many tennis players become decent golfers?
You know, I'm not 100% sure. I think one, kind of like I said, the hand-eye coordination with a racket and a tennis ball and a golf club and a golf ball could be some of it. You know, tennis, we're swinging at a ball. Golf, you're swinging at a ball. It's a little different. You know, unlike basketball and football, you're shooting or you're catching. It's a completely different motion than swinging a golf club. Where tennis, the swinging, you know, with something in your hand hitting something, there's just a lot of similarities.
I know you said you grew up in Vegas. When you were, you know, growing up, were you connected to Agassi at all? I know Andre Agassi's been in Vegas for a long time.
Not really. I mean, I moved away from Vegas when I was 9 years old to Southern California.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So by the time I was really kind of in the thick of things as like a junior tennis player, it was mostly in Southern California. But I've been close with Andre for years, and he's done incredible things in Vegas, and he's still remains somewhat close to a lot of the American tennis players, and he's kind of pops his head in from time to time at tournaments, is always cheering for everyone, and so he's you know, incredible guy.
Yeah, no, I remember covering Andre Agassi when he was had long hair and wore denim shorts. I remember calling him the denim dynamo on the tennis court. But what about the American tennis scene, particularly in the men's game? Do you think we're going to have, you know how many junior players are coming up in the caliber of the game now? Do you think we're going to see any Americans kind of penetrate in the top rankings in the near future, Sam?
I hope so. I mean, who knows? All I can do is cheer for them. But I think, you know, on the women's side, we've been incredible with Venus and Serena, and then Sloane Stephens winning the U.S. Open, and then Sophia Kenin in Australia. You know, they're doing their part. On the men's side, we just haven't had Grand Slam champions. And the guys in the past set the bar so high with Sampras, Agassi, Courier, Chang. They were always in the mix. So I think, you know, in order to get men's tennis really back on that stage, we're going to need not only just like one guy winning the Grand Slam champion, but a handful of guys winning like multiple Grand Slams. And I know all those young guys and even the older guys, everyone's working as hard as they can to do it. But the competition just gets tougher and tougher around the world. And, you know, I'm cheering for all the young guys to win Grand Slam so we can get tennis as big and as popular as possible in America.
Sam Querrey, thanks so much for joining us here on Sports Interview with Ann Liguori.
My thanks to Matt Adams, golf analyst for NBC and the Golf Channel, and to tennis star Sam Querrey. And to Kyle Lynch in the studio. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Be safe, be well, stay active, and be nice. I'll talk to you next Saturday morning from 7 to 8 right here on Sports Interview with Ann Liguori.